Hello and welcome back to a Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. You're listening to our special podcast with Bristol Bears director of rugby, Pat Lamb. We hope you enjoyed the first part where Pat went into great depth around Bristol Bears and the vision the club have. Next up is part two, and he'll be talking about his playing career, his early coaching career, as well as his time with Connacht before getting into his Mars 15. So, hope you enjoyed the first one. And here's part two now with Bristol Bears director of rugby, Pat Lamb.
And we're talking about sort of the future there, Pat. But if you don't mind, just going back to sort of the past and in terms of your playing career and into sort of the coaching you are now. And you sort of mentioned, obviously, Charles coming through and you knowing him through that period. But for you, growing up in New Zealand, I mean, we've spoken to Dane Coles recently and on Brad Shields as well, and they are just so in awe of how much New Zealand has such an impact on people's lives and rugby in particular. What was it like growing up in New Zealand when rugby is such a major part of society?
Yeah, without a doubt. You know, look, I got my self-esteem, my self-worth for the game of rugby because, again, although I was born in New Zealand, both my parents are from Samoa. They say Samoa here. But it's Samoa, some more money, some more food. But what happened is, you know, so in those days in the 70s, there was dawn raids and deportations and, you know, the Samoans were sort of, minority obviously were considered factory workers. So it wasn't necessarily, you know, looked on as, you know, positively in some areas. So when you came through and in class, there wasn't too many Pacific Islanders with me. So, you know, so I was pretty shy and, you know, but well, what I found when we went out and played this game that, you know, suddenly everyone wanted me to be in their team. And suddenly, you know, when you do the old, okay, let's pick teams, Ole Pat, you know, you're not never ever the last one picked. And that was massive because everyone played it in lunchtimes, you know, and it's changed a lot now because there's so many other interests and things you can do. But in those days when I came through, rugby was like church, was like a religion. And everyone played it. And if you're good at it, you you got to go places. And certainly that's what rugby was for me coming through. But, you know, I look at it now, it has changed a lot, even though it is still the national game. It's changed a lot. But in those days, similar to you talk about the Michael Jordan, but you go back to the 70s and 80s, it was definitely like a religion in New Zealand.
And you kind of mentioned sort of you representing Samoa. Is that right to say, or Samoa, or have I got that wrong?
Samoa.
There we go.
Yeah, very good.
And how important was it for you to represent your nation, if you like? Because I know you obviously played that non-cap game for the All Blacks, but then I guess your decision was vindicated by the fact you had so many fond memories playing for your country.
Yeah, I mean, the thing for me, when you're growing up in New Zealand, like I was very proud, born in New Zealand and Samoa, I was very proud to be a Kiwi. And I am very proud Kiwi, and I'm also proud Samoan. It's, you know, you're growing up in the country that you're born in, but, you know, you never forget, you know, for your family and holidays and so forth, that who, you know, your Samoan heritage. But everything in those days was about being an All Black when you're growing up. And Samoa wasn't big on the international stage of that thing. Rugby went 87 World Cup, they weren't invited, so it didn't help matters. But certainly coming through 80s, left school in the 90s, I was making my way through the Auckland system. But the dream was always to be an All Black, and then Samoa qualified for the 91 World Cup. And when I was playing for Auckland, played Samoa, we won, and the coach asked me, who I knew, they'd like me to go to the World Cup, and you couldn't, you know, I'm sitting there going, all right, geez. In those days, there was no eligibility because obviously Samoa wasn't that you could change countries. So I said, well, if I don't get a World Cup, I'll never go to one. And this will be the last one, a big chance, you know. So we went, and it was the massive highlight of my playing career. You know, what we did when we beat Wales, we almost beat Australia, the eventual winners. We lost 9-3, and then we hammered Argentina. And then we had gave Scotland a good run in there. But it wasn't the fact of what we did on the field, is what happened off the field. So I go back to the 70s and my upcoming about Samoa, and suddenly it just lifted Samoan people and all around, you know, they just suddenly got the sense of pride. And I was a school teacher at the time. And, you know, all young Samoan kids are going to be an All Black. Suddenly they say, I'm going to play for the Mani Samoa, I'm going to play for Samoa. You know, and everyone, it just put Samoa on the map in so many ways. And that group did a great job. You know, there's a lot of good memories there. And then, but after that, you know, I always had this ambition to be an All Black, and I got asked to trial for the All Blacks the next year. I was in the New Zealand Sevens. So I had a trial. I didn't make the team at that stage. Then I got called over to Australia as a replacement. And my first game was, I think I'm the only All Black to play that never trained with them. So I came in the night, played the next day. And 32 minutes into the game, we were down 7-3, and I felt a crack on my ribs. And I thought I'd carry on for a bit more, and then I couldn't anymore. So I went off, and so that ended up being a few months off. And then 93, I got another All Black trial. And but I was playing for the New Zealand Sevens and Scotland and the World Cup Sevens, the first World Cup Sevens, and I did my cruciate. So that was gone. And then 94, Sam Moore came back and said, it's over to you, but we'd like you to be leader and come back and Sam Moore. And I always said, like, I gave this a go. New Zealand's in great place, Samoa. And then I said, oh, if I go back, I'm never going to change. Even though you could, I'm not going to change again. I'm going to go to Samoa and help them and put everything into Samoa rugby. And I was really pleased with what we did with Samoa rugby and went to the 95 and 99 World Cup where I retired.
Yeah, and it probably involved that as well, Pat. Obviously, your club career over in England as well. Obviously, great memories with Newcastle and European memories with Northampton. Did all those experiences that you've achieved help you in terms of your coaching? Did you take a lot from what you've been able to achieve? Because it is a great list of what the things you've been able to do in your playing career as well.
Yeah, without a doubt. And that was the other benefit of playing for Samoa when we came up here. We beat Ireland, and that's where I got invited. Rob Andrews at the game. I ended up at Newcastle. Without a doubt, the different experience, different cultures. When you're growing up in New Zealand, you know, predominantly they all look up the Northern Hemisphere as second class, as the best rugby's played down in New Zealand. And you know, when you get up here, and I suppose the teacher's side of me is, you know, wherever you go and you're more people to meet, there's more things to learn. And I certainly came up here and I realized the game's different. It doesn't make it means it's worse or better. That's different. But then from a coaching's perspective, you're learning how other people think and how people around the game and different ways of doing it. And then you're able to take good bits and pieces from both. And then you're mixing with different cultures. So all of that without a doubt, you know, and we had a great team, a more experienced team, and with Newcastle where we won the premiership, and then Northampton with Ian McGeachan was a legend, real mentor, and he what we did with Northampton was special too, and we were all online. We were supposed to have a 20-year anniversary, obviously, which got cancelled with the pandemic, but everyone was sending messages because they put the game on live at 3 o'clock on the Northampton website to celebrate the 20 years, and a lot of emails and photos were going through, and everyone's noticing how old we've all got. It's been good. Great memories. That's without a doubt, going back to your question, has shaped me as a coach.
I've got to ask you about that Northampton game as well, because I read that somewhere that you were expecting a child, weren't you, a couple of days or on the day of the final, but it happened a few days before. So that must have been a very special week for you.
Yeah, it was. So it almost was only going to, yeah, like I, Steph, we've always had home births. She's tough, she's special. And so when we won the semi and got to the final, it was on the due date of Josiah. And I said to the team, because I was the captain, I said, look, I want to say it real clear. If he's due around that date, I won't be at the game. I'll be at it with my wife and having the baby. So we had contingency plans. And it sort of went public in the Northampton media, and they were, oh, can Mrs. Lamb do the right thing and have the baby early? I was like, do not say that. I got in a bit of trouble there. But anyway, Josiah arrived on the Wednesday before, and that was special. And so I had a shoulder injury, which I was lined up for surgery, and I'd been struggling the last month of that. And I said I'd play. And so that was my inspiration, really, watching Steph go through that fourth time, no painkillers. And I said, well, I can do this. I'll do this. So it was great. So every time Josiah has his birthday, I know how long ago we won it.
You mentioned before your experience at Connacht as well. And it was a club that, as you said, had a really small budget. But I think the term miracle has been used quite a lot about what you guys were able to achieve. How special is that in terms of your career?
Yeah, that's probably the coaching highlight, because when you take a group it just shows again the system and that we work works game culture leadership. And I always said to when I left Connacht, if I go anywhere that has money, I wouldn't change the system. You know, it just means you can shop and do better places. But certainly the system of game culture and leadership came through, and it was the ultimate team game because we had to rely on team, not individuals. It's a massive, massive highlight there. And it's very similar to what we're doing here. And people will always, because we have Steve Lansdowne as our backer, will always try and say that, oh, we're trying to buy this or do that. At the end of the day, we don't have Steve Lansdowne's billions. You know, what we have is the salary cap. It's exactly the same. These other clubs spend more than us. But the model Steve's really impressed with, the model that we're using to achieve his vision and what we want to do is the key. That's what we've built extreme trust with Steve and Chris in. And pre-pandemic, it was tracking really well. And I believe if the club was the way it used to be, you know, maybe we might not have that same sort of backing because Steve's very proud of the way the team is at the moment and the whole organisation and what we're doing in the community. It's exactly what he was looking for.
Absolutely. Absolutely, Pat. And just a couple more from me before I hand over to Mark for the Mars 15, which is the most important part of this podcast. In terms of the here and now with Bristol, obviously you guys third in the table at the moment. And I guess it's just as we've discussed so much on this podcast, is we all want rugby to return. And obviously the Premiership announced that players can start coming back to training. And that must be such a positive thing for you as a coach and for you as a team, because you were doing so, so well domestically and in Europe.
Yeah, it is. But we all understand the reason why. And I think the key was the incentive, and the boys had trained really well on their own. Again, as part of the plan, because the motivation that we have is put to them is that there's only a short window to win trophies. Trophies are sitting there. You know, and normally you've got to come at the start of the season, you've got a long season. But this is going to be very similar to, New Zealand competition, the ITM Cup, because you normally play 10 games, so you're going to have a short amount of games. And every time it's pushed back, I said, instead of looking at it as a negative, oh, we're only going to play this amount of games. Now you look at the prize at the end. It's like home births. You know, go through all the pain, once they arrive. There's a mark. Well, we can't really say that, Mark, but we just know that at the end there's a blessing.
Yeah. Yeah.
The wives go through the pain, but, you know, we feel their pain.
And obviously the here and now and the near future is obviously with Bristol, and you're hoping to achieve what you set out to do when you first stepped in it, when the club won the championship. But one thing I've got to mention is there is a Wales fan among us, and I know recently you've said that one day you may like to coach Wales, and this is all about the natural players that produce is similar to New Zealand. What do you see in Wales, and why do you think Wayne Pivac's got quite a special opportunity there to achieve something with them?
Well, firstly, I want to correct that, and I knew that would come out that way. And I was talking to a Welsh podcast, and I said to the guys, and I made it very clear, I'm not advertising for a job or looking for a job.
Yeah,
I'm just
saying
that I would love to coach Wales in the sense that, like people say, oh, I'd love to coach the All Blacks, or I'd love to coach Bristol, I'd love to coach there. But meaning in that sense, in context.
Yeah, yeah.
But the reason being is that, you know, when you're talking about the model that I have and what we're trying to do, you know, obviously, when I was at Connacht, the level of player wasn't necessarily as good as some of the other teams, but we worked and put it together. The moment you bring better players in, and that's what we're trying to do at Bristol, and then the faster that you can make that happen, the model and the process doesn't change. And it's just, so what I see in Welsh players is very much generally speaking, as New Zealanders players, that there's a lot of natural talent in playing the game because they play it at a young age and good understanding. So then I just think that bring that together. You still have to work as a team. You still got to get your culture right. You still could have talented players, but not good people. So you still got to work through all of that. But I just think that there's naturally a lot of what I've found over the time, some real talent. Doesn't mean there isn't any in England or anywhere else. Certainly that stands out to me.
Don't worry, Pat. We're not going to get a news line out of it saying you're going to be the next Wales coach.
I saw the next day, John Lansdowne asked me. I was on a conference call with Steve Lansdowne and Chris Boy, and it was I just heard today you go, you want to coach Wales. I said, it's out of context, boys. It's out of context.
And with the Mars 15 as well, well, Pat, we obviously go through all the different positions, but one of the things that Mark flagged up to us before we go into the 15 is that you've always said about number eight and been such a tough position to play. And I know about, there's a quote when after a game Nathan Hughes played, that he played really well, but it was all about improving as well. So why is it so difficult to play in that position? And is it brilliant to see Nathan improve and listening to that advice that you're giving?
Yeah, probably number eight's the best position because you got a license to do so much in the game, be involved in the game. So to do that, you've got to know the game. And I have a quote that I use with the players all the time. The good players play the game, but great players know the game. If you know the game, then you can influence the game better. And from number eight, you have a lot of opportunity to do that on attack and defence. But that's if you choose to do it. So if a number eight has low work rate, it's because he's chosen not to be involved. You know, sometimes it's difficult for the wingers, as an example, to get involved in the game. Doesn't mean they can't, because they put a lot of emphasis, go find the work. Whereas a number eight, the work can actually come to you and you can go and get it easy. So so that was the issue about work rate. And that's what my challenge was for Nathan and for other players as well, is, you know, the game has so many opportunities to show your skills and your ability, but also the thing that we value the most is your work rate and the things that don't require talent, because then that's coming back to love again. That's coming back to sacrifice, coming back to, you know, for the benefit of the team, you know, rather than doing just the flashy things. Don't get me wrong, you can be sacrifice a lot and do the flashy things for the team. But, you know, I know the general public, when they watch games, will recognise, you know, all the good things that are happening. That's great. But what we do as a team, recognise the unseen work, recognise the love.
I had a flashback to an image in my head when you retired, Pat, when you were stood on the sideline, Northampton kit, and you were within shouting distance of your old mate, Dean Ryan, a different number eight. You were probably more athletic. He was more of the enforcer, I would imagine.
Yeah, we balanced each other really well, Dean. When he brought me up, he was the player coach. And, man, he was brutal. Like, as in tough, Royal Army. But, mate, good mates with him. Really respect him. Really good guy. But the way he did things was very much Michael Jordan-like. Very much... this is where we go and get it done, and no prisoners, if you like. But I think, you know, certainly on the field, there's another guy, Richard Arnold and Pete Walter. We were the back rowers. All had different things. And Dean was great. He, you know, like, we talk about the flashy stuff and the unseen stuff. Dean and Rob Andrews said to me, "We brought you here to play. You don't have to." There's a lot of guys that just want to hit rucks. So don't worry about hitting too many rucks. Most important thing, get your hands on the ball and play. I ended up, I think, I was top try scorer in the first, and scored a lot of tries because I said, thanks, okay, I'll do that. but we balanced well because Dean would look after that. But yeah, you wouldn't mess with Dean Ryan on the field. And top bloke.
So we're into the main event now, Pat. Okay. And one thing I'm going to pose as a question, but I think it's a rhetorical question, is I just wonder what Pat Lamb, the player, was like to coach. We've heard a lot from Pat Lamb, the coach, but what was Pat Lamb, the player, like to coach?
Oh, it would have been a pain in the backside for some guys because I was very much a why person. I was very, you know, inquisitive. I wanted to know, because I was big picture, I wanted to know. And I caught out a few coaches like this because they bring in drills and stuff. And I said, okay, I'm going, I wanted to know how this fits into this. And if they couldn't give me a reason why, I realised he's not very good, you know, as he's gone through. And that's why I put a huge emphasis on myself and staff to make sure when you're getting your message across, if you can get the why, not just this is how I want you to do it, this is what I want you to do, give the people the why. If they've got the why, right, then that motivates them to do the how and the what. So I was very much like that. I loved the game. So I loved being challenged in the game. Ian McGee can challenge me because I remember coming up and, you know, we used to be, I'm on your left, I'm on your right. And he used to always say, when I first came, and he said, I want you in behind. Just tell the guy you're in behind. I said, shouldn't I go on the left? No, let the guy in front of you determine where he's going, then you take the space. It was a totally new concept to me, and I was going, okay. And then, you know, in my head, I'm going, oh, I'm not sure this is going to work. And then you start seeing it in the game and, you know, what he did with the Lions and opening up the fences. So very much I love the game and evolvement of the game and how to, you know, it's like chess, all of that stuff. I love that. And then the other thing is that I valued coaches that that were genuine and honest, that would build a relationship, regardless if I'm selected. I had no time at all for coaches that would be my best mate when I was selected and not even talk to me when I wasn't picked. You know, and I realized in time, that's why, you know, consistency is key. And that's why I love the handshakes and the greetings, because regardless, I might have had a tough conversation with a player the night before, but I have to give him the why, and this why you're not playing and so forth, could be honest with him. And then the next day, he might be really annoyed and walked out of the office, whatever it is. Next morning, give him a hug. How you doing? You know, because why? Because that's what I do every morning. So I'm not suddenly doing it. So relationships are important and for me, and knowing the why.
So here's the premise, Pat. Mars have landed. They've challenged us to a game of rugby to decide the future of civilization. So the future of your beloved Long White Cloud Island, the future of our lovely rainy country, all at stake through one game. And because it's slightly bonkers, we're going to ask you to pick a 15 of players that you've played with. So we can go back to any era, any time. Over to you. I think this will be something to behold, this 15.
I hope so. It's difficult. It was always difficult, but you know, you play with so many, so it's difficult to narrow it down, but I'll give it a go. Number one, loosehead prop, Peter Fatiolofa, Peter Fats. Samoan captain for many years, unfortunately passed away recently. Legend, but unbelievable. When you talk about, so a real enforcer, you know, your piano mover by day, but unbelievable character. He was the one who used to get up in a speech and say, you can call me Coconut, just make sure you're my friend. So things like that. He was a real humour and he held the team together. But great player. Led his time and being able to scrum, but also play in the open field. So hooker, number two, Sean Fitzpatrick. I came through when I started and he was already established. Real competitive winner. And you know, very successful, very much demanded high standards, and led the All Blacks for many years. And you know, certainly when I came through as an Aucklander, he had a big influence in the environment there. Number three, I went for Gary Pagel, Northampton.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, big Gary. I mean, when I played for Newcastle, me and him had a bit of a scrap. I think he stood on my head, and. But it's like most South Africans, you know, when you're playing them, they're different. It's chalk and Jekyll and Hyde off the field. What a great man. And but again, when you want a forward pack, you want a team that will be feared. Now, teams won't say that they fear you. You just know they fear you because you've got some strong. So if you got Martians coming down and they see Fats and they see they see Gary Pagel, you know, they won't take a backward step. Second row, I had Robin Brook, a good friend of mine when I came through club rugby, played the All Blacks. And again, he probably started that role of a lock six. You know, unbelievable. In those days, you know, his jumping power, because before the lifting, he could jump. His standing jump was incredible. But he could play in the open. And I like my back five being all athletic. And he was certainly one of those. And at number five, I had you got to win ball in the lineup, and you also got to have a character. So I go for Dottie Ware. Dottie was an all rounder. You know, obviously there would be possibly better players than Dottie in that sense. But when you say, okay, what do you want? You know, dominate the air. Dottie would win the ball in the air, no problem with his height and his athleticism. But again, when you've got a Fitzpatrick and a Pagel and some serious guys, you've got to have guys that will keep the change room and the culture interesting. And Dottie always did that. Number six, we're talking about balance earlier in the back row, Tim Rodber at Northampton. Yeah, another army man. And Tim was superb. You know, he was a tough bugger. He was speed. He could hit, really tackle as well. And I think he complements the two other back rowers that come in nicely. He was tall as well, could win the line out, could play in the second row. So we had, we'd have good ball from the lineup, but we'd have some good, again, some awesome big hitters. Number seven was a guy, Michael Jones, legend. Changed the whole game, back row play. He was a back playing in the forwards body, but he was tough as nails. You know, absolute, you know, gentleman on and off the field, but would hit you hard and tackle hard, and never got into any scraps. But again, with perfect link for the back slave. Number eight couldn't go past Zinzan Brook. I was talking to Zinny the other day when we were talking about Last Dance, and I said, man, that was you. You know, Zinny was so competitive. He wanted to win at everything, but he would get really frustrated, which is why I didn't think he would be good for coaching, because he would want it now and he wanted here, and you got to be at this standard or you're useless. Either get up here or you're useless. And but again, and another good character off the field. So I went for guys who are really good rugby players, great rugby players, but they had that quality that made them winners, and Zinny was a winner. You know, no one drops a drop goal in World Cup semi-final like he did against England. You know, he did it many times in club rugby when we played together as well. So Zinzan Brook. Nine was difficult. Gary Armstrong and Matt Dawson couldn't decide between the two. Dawson was right out there. You know, like we're seeing in public now. You know, he was a real character, a real cheeky bugger. Yeah. In that sense, Gary Armstrong was a cheeky bugger too, but he was tough as nails. Absolutely. Like, you have ice and snow and stuff, and he trained the house down. And I could never understand him, of course, because his accent, but we could understand each other really well on the rugby field. And so I've decided that against the Martians, you know, Dawes could talk his way through it really well, and Gary would just show by action. So I think we probably need more of a Gary Armstrong, and that's why I put Dawes into Waterboy, because he could encourage each other and tell each other and give the plan and the tactics. So Matt Dawson, Waterboy, Gary Armstrong, studying up. 10 was only one person, Johnny Wilkinson. You know, obviously, Johnny came through as a schoolboy at Newcastle, and he came in my second year. We took him under our wing. And you know, I remember at the time seeing him at training. I carried the ball one time, and he hit me hard. I went, whoa, this little schoolboy, he can hit. And and you could see then, I remember right from the beginning, is commitment and dedication to try and get better. I mean, it was snowing. I remember we were all standing in Newcastle, snow outside, dark. There was a spotlight, floodlight on, and there's Johnny out there kicking. We were all having our soup and everything, and he just kept going. So I knew that he'd be great. And so he'd be quality. Plus, he could tackle. We need tacklers as well. At 12, Frank Bunce. It was a tough between Frank Bunce or Alan Tate. Slightly different type of players, good men, but I went for Frank Bunce. He, again, an enforcer, great off the field. Frank Bunce there. At centre, I was hard to pick between Samoan legend Tu'u Vaenga, who played in that 91 World Cup. He was my right-hand man in the team, particularly culture-wise. He was like a chief in Samoa, so he could do a lot of the discipline for me in that area. Great, great man. But in the end, I went for Inga Tuigamala, another good friend. I put Inga at centre. Again, we need some damage. Right. So, you know, he was the original Manutuolangi, if you like, or Jonah Lomi, which leads me to Jonah Lomi. So I put Jonah Lomi on one wing. Again, the Martians can deal with him. We all know what he was like. And on the other side, a good balance is a guy, Eric Rush. Eric Rush.
Sevens player.
And again, he would bring a lot of humour to the group. And then at fullback, I had a guy, Shane Health, who I came through with school rugby all the way through. And again, a real competitor. You know, he broke his neck when he was young and came fought back from that. So that would be the group.
Played for Wales as well.
Played for Wales as well, and he wasn't even Welsh.
That's your link, yeah.
Yeah, Granigan.
So you've got a coach and a manager, a kit man and a water boy next to select.
Oh, I'm the coach. I'd love to coach all of these guys. You know, to be able to tell them what to do, man, would be awesome. Particularly Dan and Fitzy, that would be great. And then kit man would be Junior Paramore. I've got him here, JP. No one messes with JP. Gear always comes back. JP would look after that. And more importantly, if we got an injury, JP could come in and play anywhere on the field. Matt Dawson as well, water boy. Manager, I hadn't really thought about the manager. The manager one was the only one I had left. Actually, I'd probably put, let's see, Ian McGeechan as my, as my manager.
Yeah, wow, that's a setup.
Yeah, he could advise me on a lot of things, and and he'd run the culture really well.
Wow, that is a 15. It's a proper team.
That's a brilliant team, Pat. Yeah, one thing I wanted to ask about Sean Fitzpatrick as well. Dane Coles has been on the podcast recently, and Dane decided to stick him on the wing. Would you ever be tempted to put Sean Fitzpatrick out there?
They'd probably put him on the wing or myself on the wing. They used to criticise that we'd always score tries out there, but certainly Fitzy was accused of being on the wing. But see, he was ahead of the time. That's why I said we're ahead of our time, mate. There's no point, you know, going somewhere where you know the ball is coming back.
Brilliant, brilliant, Pat. Well, Pat, it's been an absolute privilege and a pleasure to listen to your insights as a coach and have a chat with you this afternoon. We really appreciate you taking the time to speak to us on the Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union. So thanks very much, Pat, for your time.
Thanks, guys. Take care, eh? Been a pleasure.
And many thanks, as always, to Rob, Mark and Dave for their time this afternoon. Dave, anything you want to add in terms of the website? Because I know the merchandise is flying out the door at the moment.
Yeah, just get yourselves over to looseheads.co.uk, enter code POD at checkout for 10% off.
Perfect, perfect. Well, many thanks to Rob, Mark and Dave, and a special thanks once again to Pat Lamb for joining us this afternoon. That's been a Loose Heads podcast in association with Talking Rugby Union.